below. Judging from the warm strawberry fragrance wafting from the cracks in the stone, I guessed this was the same well we'd used to exit the labyrinth. "You're making me nervous," I said. "Would you come down?" "No," she said.
"Of course not," I muttered.
I climbed up, despite the fact that scaling walls really wasn't in my skill set. Oh, who am I kidding? In my present state, I didn't have a skill set. I joined Meg on the edge, dangling my feet over the abyss from which we'd escaped. Had it really been only this morning? I couldn't see the net of strawberry plants below in the shadows, but their smell was powerful and exotic in the desert setting. Strange how a common thing can become uncommon in a new environment. Or in my case, how an uncommonly amazing god can become so very common. The night sapped the color from Meg's clothes, making her look like a grayscale stoplight. Her runny nose glistened. Behind the grimy lenses of her glasses, her eyes were wet. She twisted one gold ring, then the other, as if adjusting knobs on an old-fashioned radio. We'd had a long day. The silence between us felt comfortable, and I wasn't sure I could tolerate any further scary information about our Hoosier prophecy. On the other hand, I needed explanations. Before I went to sleep in this place again, I wanted to know how safe or unsafe it was, and whether I might wake up with a talking horse in my face. My nerves were shot. I considered throttling my young master and yelling, "Tell me now!" But I decided that might not be sensitive to her feelings.
"Would you like to talk about it?"
I asked gently.
"No."
Not a huge surprise. Even under the best of circumstances, Meg and conversation were awkward acquaintances.
"If Aethales is the place mentioned in the prophecy," I said, "your ancient roots, then it might be important to know about it, so we can stay alive."
Meg looked over. She didn't order me to leap into the strawberry pit, or even to shut up. Instead, she said,
"Here,"
and grabbed my wrist. I had become used to waking visions, being yanked backward down memory lane whenever godly experiences overloaded my mortal neurons. This was different. Rather than my own past, I found myself plunged into Meg McCaffrey's, seeing her memories from her point of view. I stood in one of the greenhouses before the plants grew wild. Well-ordered rows of new cactus pups lined the metal shelves, each clay pot fitted with a digital thermometer and moisture gauge. Misting hoses and grow lights hovered overhead. The air was warm, but pleasantly so, and smelled of freshly turned earth. Wet gravel crunched under my feet as I followed my father on his rounds. Meg's father, I mean. From my vantage point as a tiny girl, I saw him smiling down at me. As Apollo, I'd met him before in other visions. A middle-aged man with dark curly hair and a broad freckled nose. I'd witnessed him in New York, giving Meg a red rose from her mother, Demeter. I'd also seen his dead body, splayed on the steps of Grand Central Station. His chest a ruin of knife or claw marks. On the day Nero became Meg's stepfather. In this memory of a greenhouse, Mr. McCaffrey didn't look much younger than in those other visions. The emotions I sensed from Meg told me she was about 5 years old. The same age she'd been when she and her father wound up in New York. But Mr. McCaffrey looked so much happier in this scene, so much more at ease. As Meg gazed into her father's face, I was overwhelmed by her pure joy and contentment. She was with Daddy, Life was wonderful.
Mr. McCaffrey's green eyes sparkled. He picked up a potted cactus pup and knelt to show Meg.
I call this one Hercules, he said, because he can withstand anything.
He flexed his arm and said,
"Grrr,"
which sent little Meg into a fit of giggles.
Hercules, she said, show me more plants.
Mr. McCaffrey set Hercules back on the shelf, then held up one finger like a magician.
Watch this.
He dug into the pocket of his denim shirt and presented his cupped fist to Meg.
Try to open it, he said.
Meg pulled at his fingers.
I can't.
You can. You're very strong. Try really hard.
Grrr,
said little Meg. This time she managed to open his hand, revealing 7 hexagonal seeds, each the size of a nickel. Inside their thick green skins, the seeds glowed faintly, making them look like a fleet of tiny UFOs.
Oh,
said Meg.
Can I eat them?
Her father laughed.
No, sweetheart. These are very special seeds. Our family has been trying to produce seeds like this for,
he whistled softly,
a long time. And when we plant them,
what?
Meg asked breathlessly.
They will be very special,
her dad promised.
Even stronger than Hercules.
Plant them now!
Her father ruffled her hair.
Not yet, Meg. They're not ready. But when it's time, I'll need your help. We'll plant them together. Will you promise to help me?
I promise, she said,
with all the solemnity of her 5-year-old heart. The scene shifted. Meg padded barefoot into the beautiful living room of Ithales, where her father stood facing a wall of curved glass, overlooking the nighttime city lights of Palm Springs. He was talking on the phone, his back to Meg. She was supposed to be asleep, but something had woken her. Maybe a bad dream? Maybe the sense that Daddy was upset.
No, I don't understand,
he was saying into the phone.
You have no right. This property isn't... Yes, but my research can't... That's impossible.
Meg crept forward. She loved being in the living room. Not just for the pretty view, but for the way the polished hardwood felt against her bare feet. Smooth and cool and silky, like she was gliding across a living sheet of ice. She loved the plants Daddy kept on the shelves and in giant pots all around the room. Cacti blooming in dozens of colors, Joshua trees that formed living columns holding up the roof, growing into the ceiling and spreading across it in a web of fuzzy branches and green spiky clusters. Meg was too young to understand that Joshua trees weren't supposed to do that. It seemed completely reasonable to her that vegetation would weave together to help form the house. Meg also loved the big circular well in the center of the room. The cistern, Daddy called it. Railed off for safety, but so wonderful for how it cooled the whole house and made the place feel safe and anchored. Meg loved to race down the ramp and dip her feet in the cool water of the pool at the bottom. Though Daddy always said, don't soak too long, you might turn into a plant. Most of all, she loved the big desk where Daddy worked. The trunk of a mesquite tree that grew straight up through the floor and plunged back down again. Like the coil of a sea serpent breaching the waves, leaving just enough of an arc to form the piece of furniture. The top of the trunk was smooth and level, a perfect work surface. Tree hollows provided cubby holes for storage. Leafy sprigs curved up from the desktop, making a frame to hold Daddy's computer monitor. Meg had once asked if he'd hurt the tree when he carved the desk out of it, but Daddy had chuckled. No, sweetheart. I would never hurt the tree. Mesquite offered to shape herself into a desk for me. This, too, did not seem unusual to 5-year-old Meg. Calling a tree she, talking to it the way you would speak to a person. Tonight, though, Meg didn't feel so comfortable in the living room. She didn't like the way Daddy's voice was shaking. She reached his desk and found, instead of the usual seed packets and drawings and flowers, a stack of mail. Typed letters, thick stapled documents, envelopes, all in dandelion yellow. Meg couldn't read, but she didn't like those letters. They looked important and bossy and angry. The color hurt her eyes. It wasn't as nice as real dandelions.
You don't understand, Daddy said into the phone. This is more than my life's work. It's centuries, thousands of years' work. I don't care if that sounds crazy. You can't just...
He turned and froze, seeing Meg at his desk. A spasm crossed his face, his expression shifting from anger to fear to concern, then settling into a forced cheerfulness. He slipped his phone into his pocket.
Hey, sweetheart, he said, his voice stretched thin. Couldn't sleep, huh? Yeah, me neither.
He walked to the desk, swept the dandelion yellow papers into a tree hollow, and offered Meg his hand.
Want to check the greenhouses?
The scene changed again. A jumbled, fragmentary memory. Meg was wearing her favorite outfit, a green dress and yellow leggings. She liked it because Daddy said it made her look like one of their greenhouse friends. A beautiful, growing thing. She stumbled down the driveway in the dark following Daddy. Her backpack stuffed with her favorite blanket because Daddy said they had to hurry. They could only take what they could carry. They were halfway to the car when Meg stopped, noticing that the lights were on in the greenhouses.
Meg, her father said, his voice as broken as the gravel under their feet. Come on, sweetheart.
But Erkles, she said, and the others.
We can't bring them, Daddy said,
swallowing back a sob. Meg had never heard her father cry before. Made her feel like the earth was dropping out from underneath her.
The magic seeds? She asked. We can plant them where we're going?
The idea of going somewhere else seemed impossible, scary. She'd never known any home but Aethalis.
We can't, Meg.
Daddy sounded like he could barely talk.
They have to grow here. And now.
He looked back at the house, floating on its massive stone supports, its windows ablaze with gold light. But something was wrong. Dark shapes moved across the hillside. Men. Or something like men, dressed in black, encircling the property. And more dark shapes swirling overhead, wings blotting out the stars. Daddy grabbed her hand.
No time, sweetheart. We have to leave. Now.
Meg's last memory of Aethalis. She sat in the back of her father's station wagon, her face and hands pressed against the rear window, trying to keep the lights of the house in view as long as possible. They'd driven only halfway down the hill when their home erupted in a blossom of fire.
I gasped, my senses suddenly yanked back to the present.
Meg removed her hand from my wrist. I stared at her in amazement. my sense of reality wobbling so much I was afraid I might fall into the strawberry pit.
Meg, how did you...
She picked at a callus on her palm.
Don't know. Just needed to.
Such a very Meg answer. Still, the memories had been so painful and vivid they made my chest hurt, as if I'd been hit with a defibrillator.
How had Meg shared her past with me?
I knew satyrs could create an empathy link with their closest friends. Grover Underwood had one with Percy Jackson, which he said explained why he sometimes got an inexplicable craving for blueberry pancakes.
Did Meg have a similar talent?
Perhaps because we were linked as master and servant. I didn't know. I did know that Meg was hurting, much more than she expressed. The tragedies of her short life had started before her father's death. They had started here. These ruins were all that remained of a life that could have been. I wanted to hug her, and believe me, that was not a feeling I had often. It was liable to result in an elbow to my ribcage, or a sword hilt to my nose.
Did you...
I faltered. Did you have these memories all along? Do you know what your father was trying to do here? A listless shrug. She grabbed a handful of dust and trickled it into the pit as if sowing seeds.
Philip,
Meg said, as if the name had just occurred to her.
My dad's name was Philip McCaffrey.
The name made me think of the Macedonian king, father of Alexander. A good fighter, but no fun at all. Never any interest in music or poetry or even archery. With Philip, it was all phalanxes all the time. Boring.
Philip McCaffrey was a very good father, I said, trying to keep the bitterness out of my voice. I myself did not have much experience with good fathers.
He smelled like mulch,
Meg remembered.
In a good way.
I didn't know the difference between a good mulch smell and a bad mulch smell, but I nodded respectfully. I gazed at the row of greenhouses, their silhouettes barely visible against the red-black night sky. Philip McCaffrey had obviously been a talented man, perhaps a botanist? Definitely a mortal favored by the goddess Demeter. How else could he have created a house like Aethalia's, in a place with such natural power? What had he been working on, and what had he meant when he said his family had been doing the same research for thousands of years? The humans rarely thought in terms of millennia. They were lucky if they even knew the names of their great-grandparents. Most important, what had happened to Aethalia's, and why? Who had driven the McCaffreys from their home and forced them east to New York? That last question, unfortunately, was the only one I felt I could answer.
Caligula did this, I said, gesturing at the ruined cylinders on the hillside.
That's what Incitatus meant when he said the Emperor took care of this place. Meg turned toward me, her face like stone.
We're going to find out. Tomorrow. You, me, Grover. We'll find these people, Piper and Jason.
Arrows rattled in my quiver, but I couldn't be sure if it was the arrow of Dodona buzzing for attention or my own body trembling. And if Piper and Jason don't know anything helpful? Meg brushed the dust from her hands.
They're part of the Seven, right? Percy Jackson's friends?
Well, yes.
Then they'll know. They'll help. We'll find Caligula. We'll explore this mazy place and free the Sibyl and stop the fires and whatever.
I admired her ability to summarize our quest in such eloquent terms. On the other hand, I was not excited about exploring the mazy place, even if we had the help of two more powerful demigods. Ancient Rome had had powerful demigods, too. Many of them tried to overthrow Caligula. All of them had died. I kept coming back to my vision of the Sibyl, apologizing for her terrible news. Since when did an oracle apologize? I would spare you if I could. I would spare her. The Sibyl had insisted I come to her rescue. Only I could free her, though it was a trap. I never liked traps. They reminded me of my old crush, Britomartis. Ugh, the number of Burmese tiger pits I'd fallen into for the sake of that goddess. Meg swung her legs around.
I'm going to sleep. You should too.
She hopped off the wall and picked her way across the hillside, heading back toward the cistern. Since she had not actually ordered me to go to sleep, I stayed on the ledge for a long time, staring down into the strawberry-clogged chasm below, listening for the fluttering wings of ill omen. Chapter 12. O Pinto, Pinto, wherefore art thou, puke yellow? I'll hide in the back. Gods of Olympus, had I not suffered enough? Driving from Palm Springs to Malibu with Meg and Grover would have been bad enough. Skirting wildfire evacuation zones and the LA morning rush hour made it worse. But did we have to make the journey in Gleason Hedges' mustard-colored 1979 Ford Pinto Coupe? Are you kidding? I asked when I found my friends waiting with Gleason at the car. Don't any of the cacti own a better, I mean, another vehicle? Coach Hedge glowered. Hey, buddy, you should be grateful. This is a classic. Belonged to my granddaddy goat. I've kept it in great shape. So don't you guys dare wreck it. I thought about my most recent experiences with cars. The Sun Chariot crashing nose first into the lake at Camp Half-Blood. Percy Jackson's Prius getting wedged between two peach trees in a Long Island orchard. A stolen Mercedes swerving through the streets of Indianapolis, driven by a trio of demon fruit spirits. We'll take good care of it, I promised. Coach Hedge conferred with Grover, making sure he knew how to find the McLean house in Malibu.
The McLean should still be there, Hedge mused. At least, I hope so.
What do you mean? Grover asked. Why would they not be there? Hedge coughed.
Anyway, good luck. Give Piper my best if you see her. Poor kid.
He turned and trotted back up the hill. The inside of the Pinto smelled like hot polyester and patchouli, which brought back bad memories of disco dancing with Travolta. Fun fact. In Italian, his surname means overwhelmed, which perfectly describes what his cologne does. Grover took the wheel, since Gleason trusted only him with the keys. Rude. Meg rode shotgun, her red sneakers propped up on the dashboard as she amused herself by growing bougainvillea vines around her ankles. She seemed in good spirits, considering last night's share session of childhood tragedy. That made one of us. I could barely think about the losses she'd suffered without blinking back tears. Luckily, I had lots of room to cry in privacy, since I was stuck in the back seat. We started west on Interstate 10. As we passed by Moreno Valley, it took me a while to realize what was wrong. Rather than slowly changing to green, the landscape remained brown, the temperature oppressive, and the air dry and sour, as if the Mojave Desert had forgotten its boundaries and spread all the way to Riverside. To the north, the sky was a soupy haze, like the entire San Bernardino forest was on fire. By the time we reached Pomona and hit bumper-to-bumper traffic, Our pinto was shuddering and wheezing like a warthog with heatstroke. Grover glanced in the rearview mirror at a BMW riding our tail.
"Don't pintos explode if they're hit from behind?" he asked.
"Only sometimes," I said. Back in my Sun Chariot days, riding a vehicle that burst into flames was never something that bothered me. But after Grover brought it up, I kept looking behind me, mentally willing the BMW to back off. I was in desperate need of breakfast. Not just cold leftovers from last night's enchilada run. I would have smote a Greek city for a good cup of coffee, and perhaps a nice long drive in the opposite direction from where we were going. My mind began to drift. I didn't know if I was having actual waking dreams, shaken loose by my visions the day before, or if my consciousness was trying to escape the backseat of the Pinto. But I found myself reliving memories of the Erythrian Sibyl. I remembered her name now. Hierophily, friend of heroes. I saw her homeland, the Bay of Erythrae, on the coast of what would someday be Turkey. A crescent of windswept golden hills, studded with conifers, undulated down to the cold blue waters of the Aegean. In a small glen near the mouth of a cave, a shepherd in homespun wool knelt beside his wife, a naiad of a nearby spring, as she gave birth to their child. I will spare you the details, except for this. As the mother screamed in her final push, the child emerged from the womb, not crying, but singing. Her beautiful voice filling the air with the sound of prophecies. As you can imagine, that got my attention. From that moment on, the girl was sacred to Apollo. I blessed her as one of my oracles. I remembered Hierophily as a young woman wandering the Mediterranean to share her wisdom. She sang to anyone who would listen. Kings, heroes, priests of my temples, all struggled to transcribe her prophetic lyrics. Imagine having to commit the entire songbook of Hamilton to memory in a single sitting, without the ability to rewind, and you can appreciate their problem. Hierophily simply had too much good advice to share. Her voice was so enchanting, it was impossible for listeners to catch every detail. She couldn't control what she sang or when. She never repeated herself. You just had to be there. She predicted the fall of Troy. She foresaw the rise of Alexander the Great. She advised Aeneas on where he should establish the colony that would one day become Rome. But did the Romans listen to all her advice? Like, watch out for emperors. Don't go crazy with the gladiator stuff. Or togas are not a good fashion statement. No. No, they didn't. For 900 years, Hierophily roamed the earth. She did her best to help, but despite my blessings and occasional deliveries of pick-me-up flower arrangements, she became discouraged. Everyone she'd known in her youth was dead. She'd seen civilizations rise and fall. She'd heard too many priests and heroes say, "Wait, what? Could you repeat that? Let me get a pencil." She returned home to her mother's hillside in Erythrae. The spring had dried up centuries before, and with it her mother's spirit. But Hierophily settled in the nearby cave. She helped supplicants whenever they came to seek her wisdom, but her voice was never the same. Gone was her beautiful singing. Whether she'd lost her confidence, or whether the gift of prophecy had simply changed into a different sort of curse, I couldn't be sure. Hierophily spoke haltingly, leaving out important words that the listener would have to guess. Sometimes her voice failed altogether. In frustration, she scribbled lines on dried leaves, leaving them for the supplicant to arrange in the proper order to find meaning. The last time I saw Hierophily, yes, the year was 1509 CE. I'd coaxed her out of her cave for one last visit to Rome, where Michelangelo was painting her portrait on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Apparently she was being celebrated for some obscure prophecy long ago, when she'd predicted the birth of Jesus the Nazarene.
I don't know, Michael,
Hierophily said, sitting next to him on his scaffold, watching him paint.
It's beautiful, but my arms are not that.
Her voice seized up.
8 letters. Starts with M.
Michelangelo tapped his paintbrush to his lips. Muscular. Hierophily nodded vigorously. I can fix that, Michelangelo promised. Afterward, Hierophily returned to her cave for good. I'll admit, I lost track of her. I assumed she had faded away, like so many other ancient oracles. Yet now here she was, in Southern California, at the mercy of Caligula. I really should have kept sending those floral arrangements. Now, all I could do was try to make up for my negligence. Hierophily was still my oracle, as much as Rachel Dare at Camp Half-Blood, or the ghost of poor Trophonius in Indianapolis. Whether it was a trap or not, I couldn't leave her in a chamber of lava, shackled with molten manacles. I began to wonder if maybe, just maybe, Zeus had been right to send me to Earth, to correct the wrongs I had allowed to happen. I quickly shoved that thought aside. No, this punishment was entirely unfair. Still, ugh. Is anything worse than realizing you might agree with your father? Grover navigated around the northern edge of Los Angeles, through traffic that moved almost as slowly as Athena's brainstorming process. I don't wish to be unfair to Southern California. When the place was not on fire or trapped in a brown haze of smog, or rumbling with earthquakes or sliding into the sea or choked with traffic, there were things I liked about it. The music scene, the palm trees, the beaches, the nice days, the pretty people. Yet I understood why Hades had located the main entrance to the underworld here. Los Angeles was a magnet for human aspirations, the perfect place for mortals to gather, starry-eyed with dreams of fame, then fail, die, and circle down the drain, flushed into oblivion. There, you see, I can be a balanced observer. Every so often I looked skyward, hoping to see Leo Valdez flying overhead on his bronze dragon Festus. I wanted him to be carrying a large banner that said, "Everything's cool." The new moon wasn't for 2 more days, true, but maybe Leo had finished his rescue mission early. He could land on the highway, tell us that Camp Jupiter had been saved from whatever threat had faced them. Then he could ask Festus to blowtorch the cars in front of us to speed up our travels. Alas, no bronze dragon circled above, though it would have been hard to spot. The entire sky was bronze-colored. So, Grover, I said, after a few decades on the Pacific Coast Highway, have you ever met Piper or Jason? Grover shook his head. Seems strange, I know. We've all been in SoCal for so long. But I've been busy with the fires. Jason and Piper have been questing and going to school and whatever. I just never got the chance. Coach says they're nice. I got the feeling he'd been about to say something other than nice. Is there a problem we should know about? I asked. Grover drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. Well, they've been under a lot of stress. First, they were looking for Leo Valdez, then they did some other quests, then things started to go bad for Mr. McLean. Meg glanced up from braiding a bougainvillea.
Piper's dad?
Grover nodded. He's a famous actor, you know. Tristan McLean. A frisson of pleasure went up my back, I loved Tristan McClain in King of Sparta, and Jake Steele too, The Return of Steel. For a mortal, that man had endless abs.
How did things go badly? I asked.
You don't read celebrity news, Grover guessed.
Sad, but true.
With all my running around as a mortal, freeing ancient oracles, and fighting Roman megalomaniacs, I'd had zero time to keep up with juicy Hollywood gossip.
Messy breakup? I speculated. Paternity suit? Did he say something horrible on Twitter?
Not exactly, Grover said. Let's just see how things are going when we get there. It might not be so bad.
He said that in the way people do when they expect it to be exactly that bad.
By the time we made it to Malibu, it was nearly lunchtime. My stomach was turning itself inside out from hunger and car sickness.
Me, who used to spend all day cruising in the Sun Maserati, carsick.
I blamed Grover. He drove with a heavy hoof.
On the bright side, our Pinto had not exploded, and we found the McLean house without incident.
Set back from the winding road, the mansion at 12 Oro del Mar clung to rocky cliffs overlooking the Pacific. From street level, the only visible parts were the white stucco security walls, the wrought iron gates, and an expanse of red clay-tiled roofs. The place would have radiated a sense of privacy and zen tranquility if not for the moving trucks parked outside. The gates stood wide open. Troops of burly men were carting away sofas, tables, and large works of art. Pacing back and forth at the end of the driveway, looking bedraggled and stunned, as if he'd just walked away from a car wreck, was Tristan McClain. His hair was longer than I'd seen it in the films. Silky black locks swept across his shoulders. He'd put on weight, so he no longer resembled the sleek killing machine he'd been in King of Sparta. His white jeans were smeared with soot. His black t-shirt was torn at the collar. His loafers looked like a pair of overbaked potatoes.
It didn't seem right. A celebrity of his caliber just standing in front of his Malibu house without any guards or personal assistants or adoring fans. Not even a mob of paparazzi to snap embarrassing pictures.
What's wrong with him? I wondered. Meg squinted through the windshield.
He looks okay.
No, I insisted. He looks average. Grover turned off the engine.
Let's go say hi.
Mr. McClain stopped pacing when he saw us. His dark brown eyes seemed unfocused.
Are you Piper's friends?
I couldn't find my words. I made a gurgling sound I hadn't produced since I first met Grace Kelly.
Yes, sir, said Grover. Is she home?
Home.
Tristan McClain tasted the word. He seemed to find it bitter and without meaning.
Go on inside.
He waved vaguely down the driveway.
I think she's...
His voice trailed off as he watched two movers carting away a large marble statue of a catfish.
Go ahead. Doesn't matter.
I wasn't sure if he was talking to us or to the movers, but his defeated tone alarmed me even more than his appearance. We made our way through a courtyard of sculpted gardens and sparkling fountains, through a double-wide entrance with polished oak doors and into the house. Red saltillo-tiled floors gleamed. Cream-white walls retained paler impressions where paintings had recently hung. To our right stretched a gourmet kitchen that even Edesia, the Roman goddess of banquets, would have adored. Before us spread a great room with a 30-foot-high cedar-beamed ceiling, a massive fireplace, and a wall of sliding glass doors, leading to a terrace with views of the ocean. Sadly, the room was a hollowed-out shell. No furniture, no carpets, no artwork. Just a few cables curling from the wall, and a broom and dustpan leaning in one corner. A room so impressive should not have been empty. It felt like a temple without statues, music, and gold offerings. Oh, why did I torture myself with such analogies? Sitting on the fireplace surround, going through a stack of papers, was a young woman with coppery skin and layered dark hair. Her orange Camp Half-Blood t-shirt led me to assume I was looking at Piper, daughter of Aphrodite and Tristan McLean. Our footsteps echoed in the vast space, but Piper did not look up as we approached. Perhaps she was too engrossed in her papers, or she assumed we were movers. "You want me to get up again?" she muttered. "Pretty sure the fireplace is staying here." "Ahem," I said. Piper glanced up. Her multicolored irises caught the light like smoky prisms. She studied me as if not sure what she was looking at. Oh boy, did I know the feeling. Then gave Meg the same confused once-over. She fixed her eyes on Grover and her jaw dropped.
I know you, she said. From Annabeth's photos. You're Grover.
She shot to her feet, her forgotten papers spilling across the Saltillo tiles. What's happened? Are Annabeth and Percy all right? Grover edged back, which was understandable given Piper's intense expression.
They're fine, he said. At least, I assume they're fine. I haven't actually, seen them in a while, but I have an empathy link with Percy, so if he wasn't fine, I think I'd know.
Apollo.
Meg knelt down. She picked up one of the fallen papers, her frown even more severe than Piper's. My stomach completed its turn inside out. Why had I not noticed the color of the documents sooner? All of the papers, envelopes, collated reports, business letters, were dandelion yellow.
NH Financials, Meg read from the letterhead. Division of Triumvirate.
Hey!
Piper swiped the paper from her hand.
That's private.
Then she faced me as if doing a mental rewind.
Wait. Did she just call you Apollo?
I'm afraid so.
I gave her an awkward bow.
Apollo, god of poetry, music, archery, and many other important things at your service.
Though my learner's permit reads Lester Papadopoulos. She blinked.
What?
Also, this is Meg McCaffrey, I said, daughter of Demeter.
She doesn't mean to be nosy. It's just that we've seen papers like these before.
Piper's gaze bounced from me to Meg to Grover. The satyr shrugged as if to say, welcome to my nightmare.
You're going to have to rewind,
Piper decided. I did my best to give her the elevator pitch summary. My fall to Earth, my servitude to Meg, my two previous quests to free the oracles of Dodona and Trophonius, my travels with Calypso and Leo Valdez.
Leo!
Piper grabbed my arms so hard I feared she would leave bruises.
He's alive?
Hurts, I whimpered.
Sorry, she let go. I need to know everything about Leo, now.
I did my best to comply, fearing that she might physically pull the information from my brain otherwise.
That little fire flicker, she grumbled. We search for months, and he just shows up at camp?
Yes, I agreed. There is a waiting list of people who would like to hit him. We can fit you in sometime next fall, but right now we need your help. We have to free a Sybil from the Emperor Caligula. Piper's expression reminded me of a juggler's, trying to track 15 different objects in the air at once.
I knew it, she muttered. I knew Jason wasn't telling me.
Half a dozen movers suddenly lumbered through the front door, speaking in Russian. Piper scowled.
Let's talk on the terrace, she said. We can exchange bad news.
Chapter 13. Don't move the gas grill. Meg is still playing with it. We are so kaboom. Oh, the scenic ocean vista. Oh, the waves crashing against the cliffs below and the gulls whirling overhead. Oh, the large, sweaty mover in a lounge chair checking his texts. The man looked up when we arrived on the terrace. He scowled, grudgingly got to his feet, and lumbered inside, leaving a mover-shaped perspiration stain on the fabric of the chair.
If I still had my cornucopia, Piper said, I'd shoot those guys with glazed hams.
My abdominal muscles twitched. I'd once been hit in the gut by a roasted boar shot from a cornucopia, when Demeter was especially angry with me, but that's another story. Piper climbed the terrace fence and sat on top of it, facing us. Her feet hooked around the rails. I supposed she'd perched there hundreds of times, and no longer thought about the long drop. Far below, at the bottom of a zigzagging wooden stairway, a narrow strip of beach clung to the base of the cliffs. Waves crashed against jagged rocks. I decided not to join Piper on the railing. I wasn't afraid of heights, but I was definitely afraid of my own poor sense of balance. Grover peered at the sweaty lounge chair, the only piece of furniture left on the deck, and opted to remain standing. Meg strolled over to a built-in stainless steel gas grill and began playing with the knobs. I estimated we had about 5 minutes before she blew us all to bits. So, I leaned on the railing next to Piper. You know of Caligula? Her eyes shifted from green to brown, like tree bark aging. I knew someone was behind our problems. The maze, the fires, this. She gestured through the glass doors at the empty mansion. When we were closing the doors of death, we fought a lot of villains who'd come back from the underworld. Makes sense an evil Roman emperor would be behind triumvirate holdings. I guessed Piper was about 16, the same age as... No, I couldn't say the same age as me. If I thought in those terms, I would have to compare her perfect complexion to my own acne-scarred face, her finely chiseled nose to my bulbous wad of cartilage, her softly curved physique to mine, which was also softly curved, but in all the wrong ways. Then I would have to scream, I hate you. So young, yet she had seen so many battles. She said when we were closing the doors of death, the way her high school peers might say, when we were swimming at Kyle's house. We knew there was a burning maze, she continued. Gleason and Melly told us about that. They said the satyrs and dryads. She gestured at Grover. Well, it's no secret you guys have been having a bad time with the drought and fires. Then I had some dreams. You know. Grover and I nodded. Even Meg looked over from her dangerous experiments with outdoor cooking equipment and grunted sympathetically. We all knew that demigods couldn't take a catnap without being plagued by omens and portents. Anyway, Piper continued, I thought we could find the heart of this maze. I figured whoever was responsible for making our lives miserable would be there, and we could send him or her back to the underworld. When you say we, Grover asked, you mean you and...
Jason, yes.
Her voice dipped when she spoke his name, the same way mine did when I was forced to speak the names Hyacinthus or Daphne. Something happened between you, I deduced. She picked an invisible speck from her jeans. It's been a tough year.
You're telling me, I thought.
Meg activated one of the barbecue burners, which flared blue like a thruster engine.
You guys break up or what?
Leave it to McCaffrey to be tactless about love with the child of Aphrodite, while simultaneously starting a fire in front of a satyr.
Please don't play with that,
Piper asked gently.
And yes, we broke up.
Grover bleated.
Really? But I heard... I thought...
You thought what?
Piper's voice remained calm and even. That we'd be together forever like Percy and Annabeth? She stared into the empty house, not exactly as if she missed the old furniture, but as if she were imagining the space completely redone.
Things change. People change. Jason and me. We started out oddly.
Kira kind of messed with our heads. Made us think we shared a past we didn't share.
Ah,
I said.
That sounds like Kira.
We fought the war against Gaia. Then we spent months searching for Leo. Then we tried to settle into school, and the moment I actually had some time to breathe... She hesitated, searching each of our faces as if realizing she was about to share the real reasons, the deeper reasons, with people she barely knew. I remembered how Melly had called Piper a poor girl, and the way the cloud nymph had said Jason's name with distaste.
Anyway, Piper said, things change, but we're fine. He's fine, I'm fine. At least, I was, until this started.
She gestured toward the great room, where the movers were now lugging a mattress toward the front door. I decided it was time to confront the elephant in the room. Or rather, the elephant on the terrace. Or rather, the elephant that would have been on the terrace had the movers not hauled him away.
What happened, exactly?
I asked. What's in all those dandelion-colored documents?
Like this one,
Meg said, pulling from her gardening belt a folded letter she must have filched from the great room. For a child of Demeter, she had sticky fingers.
Meg,
I said,
that's not yours.
I may have been a little sensitive about stealing other people's mail. Once Artemis rifled through my correspondence and found some juicy letters from Lucrezia Borgia that she teased me about for decades.
N.H. Financials, Meg persisted. Neos Helios. Caligula, right?
Piper dug her fingernails in the wooden rail.
Just get rid of it, please.
Meg dropped the letter into the flames. Grover sighed. I could have eaten that for you. It's better for the environment.
The stationery tastes great.
That got a thin smile from Piper.
The rest is all yours, she promised.
As for what they say, it's all legal, legal, blah, blah, financial, boring, legal.
Bottom line, my dad is ruined.
She raised an eyebrow at me.
You really haven't seen any of the gossip columns. The magazine covers?
That's what I asked, Grover said.
I made a mental note to visit the nearest grocery store checkout lane and stock up on reading material.
I am woefully behind, I admitted.
When did this all start?
I don't even know, Piper said. Jane, my dad's former personal assistant, she was in on it. Also his financial manager, his accountant, his film agent, this company, Triumvirate Holdings.
Piper spread her hands, like she was describing a natural disaster that could not have been foreseen.
They went to a lot of trouble.
They must have spent years and tens of millions of dollars to destroy everything my dad built. His credit, his assets, his reputation with the studios, all gone. When we hired Melly, well, she was great. She was the first person to spot the trouble. She tried to help, but it was much too late. Now my dad is worse than broke. He's deeply in debt. He owes millions in taxes he didn't even know about. Best we can hope for is that he avoids jail time.
That's horrible, I said.
And I meant it. The prospect of never seeing Tristan McLean's abs on the big screen again was a bitter disappointment. Though I was too tactful to say this in front of his daughter. It's not like I can expect a lot of sympathy, Piper said. You should see the kids at my school, smirking and talking about me behind my back. I mean, even more than usual.
Oh, boo-hoo, you lost all three of your houses.
Three houses? Meg asked. I didn't see why that was surprising. Most minor deities and celebrities I knew had at least a dozen. But Piper's expression turned sheepish.
I know, it's ridiculous, she said. They repoed 10 cars, and the helicopter. They're foreclosing on this place at the end of the week and taking the airplane.
You have an airplane,
Meg nodded, as if this at least made perfect sense.
Cool.
Piper sighed. I don't care about the stuff. But the nice former park ranger who was our pilot is going to be out of a job. And Melly and Gleason had to leave. So did the house staff. Most of all, I'm worried about my dad. I followed her gaze. Tristan McLean was now wandering through the great room, staring at blank walls. I liked him better as an action hero. The role of broken man didn't suit him.
He's been healing, Piper said.
Last year, a giant kidnapped him. I shuddered. Being captured by giants could truly scar a person. Ares had been kidnapped by two of them, millennia ago, and he was never the same. Before, he had been arrogant and annoying. Afterward, he was arrogant, annoying, and brittle. I'm surprised your father's mind is still in one piece, I said. The corners of Piper's eyes tightened. When we rescued him from the giant, we used a potion to wipe his memory. Aphrodite said it was the only thing we could do for him. But now? I mean, how much trauma can one person take? Grover removed his cap and stared at it mournfully. Perhaps he was thinking reverent thoughts, or perhaps he was just hungry. What will you do now?
Our family still has property, Piper said. Outside Tahlequah, Oklahoma, the original Cherokee allotment. End of the week, we're using our last flight on the airplane to go back home. This is one battle I guess your evil emperor's won.
I didn't like the emperor's being called mine. I didn't like the way Piper said home, as if she'd already accepted that she would live the rest of her life in Oklahoma. Nothing against Oklahoma, mind you. My pal Woody Guthrie hailed from Okima. But mortals from Malibu typically didn't see it as an upgrade. Also, the idea of Tristan and Piper forced to move east reminded me of the visions Meg had shown me last night. She and her father pushed out of their home by the same boring dandelion-colored legal blah-blah, fleeing their burning house and winding up in New York. Out of Caligula's frying pan, into Nero's fire. We can't let Caligula win, I told Piper. You're not the only demigod he's targeted. She seemed to absorb those words. Then she faced Meg, as if truly seeing her for the first time. You too? Meg turned off the gas burner.
Yeah. My dad. What happened?
Meg shrugged.
Long time ago,
We waited, but Meg had decided to be Meg. "My young friend is a girl of few words," I said. But with her permission,